Henry Gilhart is a Steadicam operator, that's a filmmaker,
right. Yes.
Living in Berlin. He lived in Florida, in Los Angeles,
yes,
and in other places.
Exactly.
In Germany. I got this idea that we should do, we should have this conversation because we were out on dinner, a very nice dinner, a few months ago already, where you told me that now you're going to produce your first movie, you're going to take the step from a cam operator,
correct,
to filmmaker.
Yes.
And that's, I think that fits pretty well,
yes,
for this podcast, a place where I meet people who prioritize passion over safety and money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you did. And you moved really fast because since we had this dinner, you've already finalized.
Correct. Yes.
Your shot.
Yes. Well, maybe not finalized, but it's on my external hard drive. And I made a little rough cut. I've discovered that I'm not a great editor, but that's part of the learning process. I dread the term filmmaker. I used to hate it.
Uh-huh.
Because it's such a broad term. If somebody calls themselves a filmmaker, you can be a director, you could be a writer, you could be a cameraman. And back when I started, I was so set on everybody having their set position on the movie set. So don't say filmmaker, say you're a director,
ah,
or say you're a cameraman. To me, it was always a very pretentious term.
Mm.
But now, after I've made my first film, I do call myself a filmmaker.
Yeah, I think you should.
Because it is true. You know, I wear many hats. I'm making the film. I wrote it. I produced it. I direct it. So I can call myself a writer, producer, director, which sounds even more pretentious than filmmaker, I think.
Yeah, but like I think you should take all the titles you can get now.
Exactly.
That you've taken this step. You're qualified to start using these very loaded,
yeah, maybe,
hats or terms. Yeah.
And it was always a dream of mine to make my own film. I, of course, when I was like 12, 13, 14, I was a filmmaker already, shooting some,
oh, really?
Ghetto films, as we all do in the industry.
I did as well. I really enjoyed it. But then the difference is I didn't concentrate, I didn't channel the energy there, whereas you somehow kept the focus, it seems.
Yeah, I think so. I used it as, I mean, granted, I never thought that I was going to be working in the movie industry back when I was 13, 14. It was a dream of mine, but it was never really a goal because I come from a family where I grew up in Germany, so everything is very structured. Everybody goes to college or university. Mm. In my family, you get a degree, you start working 9 to 5, and that's how you live your life.
Mm-hmm.
So doing a left turn and start working in this really unorthodox industry,
mm,
has never happened in my family. So it was never a goal of mine to say, this is what I'm going to do. It was more fate and luck, I believe, that it happened like that. I moved to the United States after my Abitur, and I figured I'm 18 years old now.
Yeah.
I can waste 2 years if nothing works out. I move back to Germany and then I'm 20 and I can always go back to university. I can become a doctor or whatever.
Was that the image that you had before?
To become a doctor, maybe. Yes. My, yeah, Abitur wasn't that great, so probably not. I,
uh-huh,
probably would have become a pilot or something.
Yes, yeah.
But I figured I'm going to use these 2 years to just see how, you know, things pan out.
What was your aim when you planned that trip to the US? Did you have something related to filmmaking in your sight?
No, not really. Uh-uh. I just moved because I wanted to. I figured I had no real plan. My first big goal was to get to America. And,
mm-hmm,
then whatever happens, happens. So, mm, I moved to America.
And to Florida directly?
To Florida directly, yeah. To Naples.
Why did you choose Florida?
My girlfriend at the time, later wife, eventually ex-wife, lived in Florida. So it was just, you know, moving to her, to be with her. So if she had lived,
you were together for that long. Wow.
Yeah, we were together since we were 16.
What?
Yeah.
Now I would like to know, how did you get to know her? If she's you're in Germany, she's in Florida.
I have family in Florida, and a cousin twice removed, and she was his next door neighbor. So I met her, very cliche, like a house party. A bunch of 16-year-olds who are definitely not drinking, because you can do that when you're 21.
Yeah.
and then, I don't know, we've had a long-distance relationship for about 2.5 years until I moved. I think her moving to Germany was never a thing. We never talked about that. Apart from that, I was very keen on moving to the United States.
Yeah.
I did a foreign exchange year in high school there already, and I've always known that that's where I'm going to move to eventually. And I did.
Okay, so with the main aim of being with your girlfriend then.
Correct.
And then the rest was a bit, like, not super clear.
Not super clear, no. Because I think if I had set myself too many goals, I'm going to move to America, I'm going to move to Florida, I'm going to work in the film industry, I don't think any of that would have happened. I just figured whatever happens, happens. I think my goal, too, was to go to college when I was in the U.S. eventually. But working in the movie industry wasn't really a big determination of mine. My first job there was working in a cupcake shop for about a year at night making cupcakes.
So, how did you like that?
At the time, I hated it.
Yeah.
But...
so many jobs you have in that age that you absolutely hate. I hated almost all the jobs.
Yeah, like, I mean...
And it smelled so bad in many of the places where I worked.
Yeah.
And it was the smells that got me.
Same.
But a cake shop should smell good.
It smells good. However, sugar and butter, which gets on your clothing when you bake and work, that smells, especially in the Florida heat. So when you come home and you smell of old butter and sugar... that's very lovely. I can tell you that.
Wow, so you did that for a year.
I did that for a year.
But how would you define, like, where did the journey, where did this journey, where did it begin?
This journey began, the movie journey?
Yeah.
It began right there, because I noticed I need to get out of here, and I cannot do this.
Yeah.
So I, at the time, I've always wanted to become a Steadicam operator since I was, like, 13, which is a very... strange and unorthodox goal to...
Can you, for like the non-initiated, very briefly explain what is a Steadicam?
Sure. A Steadicam is a special camera system that you wear on your body to give you these free-floating, flying images. For instance, people walking down a hallway, people walking along a sidewalk, going up the stairs, going down the stairs...
Is this movie, this Birdman, that's correct. Like one big Steadicam fest,
yeah,
isn't
exactly.
it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is. They cut it, obviously, to make it look like a continuous shot.
Right.
But the Steadicam operator on Birdman, Chris Harhoff, was actually my instructor for one of the workshops.
No way!
He's this really cool South African guy. And I think one of the best... top three Steadicam operators out there in the world.
Now that's cool. You got to meet him.
We're not too many people. It's a very closed group. But yeah, I think Steadicam is, it has always fascinated me because I think it looks cool. You're the coolest guy on set, period.
Okay.
It's it's a very nifty machine. You look very important. But you can do a lot of cool things with it. You can be very creative. The shots are out of this world. To think now that the technology is almost 50 years old and nothing really has changed. It's still the same idea behind the 50-year-old design. And I did an internship, I believe in like 8th grade or 9th grade in high school, You had to do like a 2-week school internship, and I did it on a movie set. My neighbor, who is a cameraman back where I grew up, he took me with him, I think with the idea of changing my mind to actually do something different and to learn a proper job. Mm-hmm. He wanted to show me, like, look how sucky it is here. Early morning hours, late days, everybody is in the sun all day. And I was there for 2 weeks, and I'm thinking, I love it.
He didn't reach his aim. Quite the opposite.
Quite the opposite.
Okay.
So fast forward to working in the cupcake shop. I saved some money to fly out to Los Angeles to do a Steadicam workshop. They're pretty pricey, and I figured, you know what, that's the best investment I can do. I can always put aside some money and then eventually do the workshop. And then sometimes you do these workshops that are like 2-3 days and you realize this is not for me.
Yeah.
Before you go out and you spend $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 on the Steadicam, and then you realize, oh crap, I don't want to do this anymore.
Right.
That's your opportunity to either change your mind and not do it, or continue with it.
Right.
And I continued with it. And then I was 19 or 20, and we moved from Naples to Orlando. My wife at the time was...
Wait, you were married as a 19-year-old already?
I was, yeah.
Damn. How old? Were you 19 on your wedding? Or?
I was 19 at my wedding.
Was that like a visa-driven decision? Or?
Maybe.
Yeah, okay, all right. Okay.
It was a pragmatic reason behind it,
okay,
yes.
Okay, okay.
No, yes. I mean, we were married for a really long time, so it wasn't like the show 90 Day Fiancé where... Okay. You get married for 3 months and then you get a divorce and eventually you become an American. No. So there was a...
I'm sure it was a catalyst.
It was a catalyst behind it. And that was actually... I was quite nervous going to the immigration office in Miami at the time. Because everybody who was there for their fiancé visas was a lot older than me.
Yeah.
So there's these two kids sitting there, and I was thinking, oh my God, they're going to kick us out.
Yeah.
They're going to accuse us all sorts of things.
Right.
And I walked in and they're like, hello, hello, goodbye, goodbye. And
okay. That was it. Nice.
And yeah, we moved to Orlando. And that was my chance to, or that was the first opportunity to maybe work somewhere in a film / television related field. I didn't have a Steadicam at the time, but my goal was to eventually become a Steadicam operator. Orlando used to be pretty big in the 90s in the movie industry. All of that has kind of died out and moved to either Atlanta or Los Angeles.
Right.
But there's some leftover production fields, mostly television, sports television, and advertising. And... I just applied at like a local advertising production company. I said, hey, I'm Henry. I'm from Germany. I've never really worked in the industry, but I do know my way around. I'm not a complete idiot. So if you need help, let me know.
Yeah.
And that company reached back out and they're like, hey, great. We actually do need some help. There's this like small commercial shoot for like an attorney's office.
And,
let me know if you... if you want to come work with us. And I did so well, apparently, that they never called me back. Because I realized the experience that I have maybe is not enough for like a semi-professional shoot. And I'm pretty sure what ruined that day on set for me was I didn't know how to coil a cable. And
what is it to coil a cable?
I think, in my opinion, the most important thing, if somebody wants to work in the movie industry, you can be a great writer, you can have a great vision, you can have a great eye for image composure. The most important thing that will make or break your movie career is how to coil a cable. And like that's a fact.
Uh-huh.
There is a special technique called the over-under, how you coil a cable, because like camera cables cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And if you coil them like your lawnmower cable, they break immediately.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't know that.
So
my only job that day was to coil cables, hundreds of them.
Oh.
So I did hand, elbow, hand, elbow, And I was so proud that after 2 hours, I was done coiling these cables incorrectly. Yeah. The lighting technician comes out. He looks at the cables and he's like, who coiled that?
No.
And everybody looked at me and I'm like, I did. And
yeah.
He's like, go.
Really?
Yeah. And
you were fired on the spot. Donald Trump style.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. And, how did that feel?
Not very great.
Yeah.
And
but like, how heavy did you take it? Because I think people can deal with setbacks in a different way. Some people are like super convinced that they are the shit, even though they do a mess up like that. Or some would be like, have a...
I don't know. I was pretty bummed out, obviously. I went home and I think I had this moment of, this is not my career path. But I met these two dudes who worked on that shoot. Who were like my age, and they were also pretty young. I think there were interns there, and I stayed in contact with them. Mm-hmm. And I wrote to them, and I'm like, hey, you know, I'm sorry I kind of made a fool out of myself. And they didn't even remember. And that was like 2 days later. They were like, wait, what happened?
Oh.
And that's where I realized, it doesn't matter, man.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't kill anybody. I didn't, like, cause the production a lot of money. Like, I didn't know how to coil a cable. But then again, I told them, I don't know a lot. You know.
Yeah.
So,
but that's such a liberation when you realize that people don't give a hardly give a shit about anything that you regarding to your work. It's really difficult to get people to give a shit about your what you do, and that's that was a big liberation when I realized that
they give a shit once it affects them negatively.
Or if you do really good work, of course, people then give a shit, but exactly. the hurdle is high.
Yeah, exactly.
That also helps me with this podcast, because I'm very critical of the few interviews that I've done, but then I was like, okay, nobody cares anyway, right? So it's interesting to publish something, because it's it takes a little bit of nerves to do that, because you have this weird overblown self-importance image, everybody will listen to this podcast and criticize me a lot, but nobody listens hardly, right? And that's kind of nice now.
You go out of the way to do this podcast. They're not doing the podcast.
No, be happy if someone listens 30 seconds.
But no one
at this point. So.
Yeah, exactly. You go out of your way to produce quality entertainment for these listeners, so you know they don't do that.
I'm at the cable coiling stage right now. It's fine. Okay.
So then I don't know. There's I took some high school prom photos or something at the time in Orlando just to kind of make some money. And it's
did you enjoy it?
No.
That way? No.
Not really. I mean, it was nice because I wasn't back in a bakery or anything like that. I didn't have to wait tables or work at a bar. It was...
Did you do that under your own name or as an employee?
I did that under my own name. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I took another Steadicam workshop. There was one that was in Florida, and I figured that might be nice to do this again. It was a little bit more intermediate, and that's when I knew, I'm going to have to pursue this more seriously, because this is really what I love doing. And I just wrote this email to a Steadicam operator in Orlando saying, hey, my name is Henry, do you want to grab a beer? Mike Germond is his name, and he worked at the Golf Channel at the time. And he was like, yeah, sure, let's grab a beer. So we went out and we met somewhere, I think City Walk, Universal or something. And he was like, so we have an opening at the Golf Channel. And I told him, again, I told the people with the cable coiling, I said, I have done the workshop. I know my way around.
Yeah.
But I have never done any live show or anything that paid,
Yeah.
And he was like, well, it's just come over to the studios, like, we'll put the rig on, we'll see what you do, and if you suck, then whatever, you know, then you suck, and we'll never talk again. And I'm like, deal, that sounds good.
Yeah.
So the next day, I drove down to the Golf Channel, and the Golf Channel is not just live golf coverage, it's also some, like, Sports Center-style news show where people sit and talking heads analyzing golf shows in like a studio atmosphere with some more or less interesting camera shots. And they also have a morning show that starts at 6 a.m. from 6 to 8 or 7 to 9, depending on the day. And the operator was leaving to move to Connecticut, I believe, for ESPN. And he said, like, do a show. It's 4 a.m. till 10 a.m. It's terrible hours. It's hard to find somebody. So you're new. That's great. If it doesn't work out, then it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
But as long as you can follow some simple camera directions and not completely suck, you're hired. So they put me on a show. It was like Tuesday at 5 a.m. So when everybody is watching.
Yeah. Prime time. It'd be fun if one could see, like, the viewership. Who the hell watches the Golf Channel at 5 a.m.?
Who knows?
Yeah.
There's a rerun, so you can watch it at 7 a.m.
Okay.
It is a show that you watch in, like, a hotel lobby. Or, like, you know, when there's a TV in the background where, like, the car rental desk is the TV that just airs random crap. That's usually the Golf Channel. Or at, like, Texas Roadhouse.
We've talked about this before, the love for the U.S. and this shoot from the hip, easygoing, fast in, fast out thing. It's a very American beginning to your journey, right? It's nice.
It is, because if this was in Germany,
I would have
taken a Steadicam workshop or 2 or 3 or 10, and I could have been the best young Steadicam operator in the world, Kobe Bryant of Steadicam. Nobody would have hired me. They would have said, do you have a degree? Do you have any paperwork? Have you?
Yeah, unless you have, like, established relationships. If your dad is so-and-so, but it's really difficult.
It's really difficult. And there they were like, okay, you know what? A young kid, you know, doesn't charge us a whole lot of money, which is a win for us.
Because
we need somebody right now. If it works out, great. If it doesn't work out, we'll find somebody else.
Exactly.
And it's that mentality of, like, they really look at your skill set rather than some supporting evidence of diplomas.
Yeah, yeah. We're on some of the nicest features of the US here.
It is. And the right turn on a red light, I think.
That's a very nice feature too. I don't know if it actually is, but I think if you're on the bike in Germany, you can do that too. I do it all the time.
Maybe,
right? I've imported the turn on right.
When I moved here, I did a right turn on a red, and I was driving.
Oh, you weren't aware that this is forbidden?
I knew it was forbidden, but I forgot. I was there for such a long time, that, and it was just like automation took over. I took a right turn, and my dad was at the passenger seat, and he looks over, and he was like, nice. You know you can't do that. I'm like, oh, yeah.
I kept calm still. That's good. Okay. So how was that? Do you remember the feeling after the first date? What did you think?
My first day doing a ride on red, or my first day at the Golf Channel?
No, like, back to the Golf Channel.
It was nerve-wracking. I talked to the director beforehand, and he knew, obviously, that I'd never done a show. And he was very nice about it. And usually there's, I don't know, like maybe 10 Steadicam shots in the show. And he really watered down the show to just one Steadicam shot that had a lot of time before and after. So if things wouldn't have worked out timing wise, it still wouldn't have been the end of the world.
Yeah.
And I had my earpiece in and I listened to the director commands, and I had shadowed like 2 shows beforehand just to listen to the director giving commands. So you understand what it actually means and what he wants from you. Because it's a really fast-paced environment, and it's like really specific lingo. They're just like, okay, ready one, take one, move one, ready three, take three. And it can be really confusing. So they were like, okay, Henry, here we go. Henry, you ready? Okay, Henry, yes, let's go.
Yeah.
Okay, Henry, make your move, and take Henry's camera. And I think it was just like a straight push into like a monitor for like some like cool bump shot.
Yeah.
And I, like, after that, I had so much adrenaline in my body, I don't remember anything.
Yeah.
Like, I rewatched it afterwards.
Yeah.
Just for fun, and I knew I did it. Mm-hmm. There's photo evidence that I was actually there wearing the camera. I have no recollection of any of that. It's like when you get married, your wedding day, you're like, I don't know what happened. I can see I was in the photo, so I was probably there.
Yeah, a lot of nerves.
A lot of
nerves. You really threw yourself out there.
And I was there for 6 years almost. So I did, I guess, not make a complete fool out of myself. I ended up traveling with the Golf Channel a little bit, to Bedminster, New Jersey, Arizona, Trump National Doral a couple times for tournaments. So I got out of the house a little bit, which was nice.
Yeah.
And, they had their own Steadicam, so I didn't have to buy a Steadicam, which was nice.
Mm-hmm.
And pay was very good.
Really?
Even for, now thinking it was very good for a young kid doing Steadicam. As a freelance Steadicam operator, maybe not so much. But it allowed me to be a single income household where my wife went to college at the time.
Mm.
We were able to afford, you know, an apartment and a car.
That's awesome.
And I put money to the side to eventually buy my own Steadicam.
I would say, like, these kind of jobs, that's exactly what one should do when you're in your 20s.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
It's your time to learn.
Yeah.
And to take big risks. And it's really nice.
Because if you fail...
It doesn't matter. You don't have three kids to feed or...
Correct. You know.
An established reputation that you're worried about. It's real nice that...
Exactly.
The phase, that life chapter. Dude, that is it. Maybe it's fair to say that the Golf Channel was for you what Hamburg was for the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know that the Beatles, when they began, they just played in Hamburg all the time before they had the routine.
Made them huge.
They got their 10,000 hours. And
that's
I don't know if it was at the Reeperbahn or wherever they go.
I would have done Steadicam at the Reeperbahn too if I had the opportunity to.
Yeah, at the Pennymarkt.
They just remodeled the Pennymarkt. It looks really nice and funky
really
now.
Yeah, so. Okay, for the non-German listeners, it's like some YouTube clip at like a low price grocery store at a very... Is it? Yeah, it is like a red light district in Hamburg.
Yeah.
Little side note there. Okay.
So I don't know if I got 10,000 hours in. I should do the math maybe, but I eventually bought my own Steadicam and I felt comfortable enough to go out into the real world as a freelancer because I was on payroll there. I was a full-time employee at this at the Golf Channel. Freelance work was allowed, albeit a little frowned upon, because they don't want you to go to the competition, to competitive networks, and then say, hey, I can't work for you guys today because tomorrow I work for ESPN or something.
Yeah, yeah, I get it.
It was kind of a don't ask, don't tell policy. A lot of people did do that work. I got the chance to do a few Thursday night and Sunday night football games in Jacksonville, which was cool. Really great to do Steadicam on like a football field sideline. That's when I noticed like I want to really become a full-time freelance Steadicam operator. And then I got this phone call from a director who was unknown to me at the time, Sean Baker, who did Tangerine and later the Florida project in Florida. And he said, hey, so we're working on this feature film and we're hiring local operators and local people only to do this film. Are you available? Blah, blah, blah. Monday, Thursday, Friday or something. And, that was the first time I did a feature film. And I was, I think, 24 at the time.
Wow.
And the movie ended up winning. Or no, it was nominated for an Academy Award in 2016 or 17. And after that, people started calling and they were like, hey, so are you available? Are you in Los Angeles?
Oh.
Are you in Los Angeles?
Uh-huh.
You're in LA, right?
Yeah.
And I wasn't. And that was when I noticed, like, okay, Florida was a great stepping stone into right. the real world.
Yeah.
But I cannot live here because I've been getting phone calls and inquiries from people in California.
Mm.
And they're expecting you to show up, like, the next day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was some people that I knew from the workshops. And my wife at the time was done with school. So we decided to move to LA, which was a scary move because I did have like one or two jobs lined up.
Yeah.
But I wasn't, you know, nobody knew I was there. And the competition is a lot bigger.
Yeah.
And nobody really waits for you, for Henry, who just moved here from Florida. Nobody
yeah.
gives a fuck.
Yeah.
So what I did at the time was I did a two-day week at the Golf Channel for like 6 months. I would fly from Los Angeles to Florida.
Oh, okay.
I would work 2-3 days at the Golf Channel and then fly back to L.A.,
and you were still the single earner of the household.
At the time,
yeah.
there was a little bit of income coming in mm-hmm. from my wife, who started a special effect career.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, that income surpassed my income.
Mm.
But at the time, yes, I was still the sole breadwinner.
Mm.
And Los Angeles is very expensive compared
right.
to Florida. So I would just fly to Orlando weekly to basically, you know, cover my bills.
Yeah, yeah.
And I felt really important, like this jet setter dude who now flies to Florida to do a show and then back to Hollywood.
Mm.
That was definitely a little braggy rights there.
Yeah.
Then I eventually found my groove of doing advertising. I did a lot of advertising in Los Angeles. I did a lot of music videos. I think starting out, everybody does a lot of music videos.
Mm-hmm.
Advertising was interesting to me because they're like mini movies. It tells a story in like mm. 30 to 60 seconds. It's not live television. I wanted to get away from the live television. Live
yeah.
TV is soul-sucking. You don't tell a story. I'm a storyteller.
Yeah.
And doing like a sports TV show, you just point your camera at something.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And I don't like it. Like, I'm not like a tripod, you know. I want to tell a story,
yeah.
you know, with my camera. Advertising allows you to do this.
So how quickly did you reach that stage when you were at the Golf Channel? Because, I mean, you were there for 6 years. Like, when do you remember, like, when did you start to get bored or feel like, this is
relatively
ready for the next thing?
Quickly.
Yeah, I would assume, huh?
Probably within the first 1 or 2 years. Mm. But for practical reasons, I couldn't quit.
Yeah.
Because I had just bought a house at the time.
Right.
So that wouldn't have been the smartest mm. decision to just quit and then go freelance. And also, I didn't feel comfortable to go freelance at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have had 2 years of experience. And when I first started, I used to, as like a kid, I wrote emails to a bunch of professional Steadicam operators and just asked them like, hey, how did you do that? How did you become who
that's
you
super
are?
Cool that you did that. That takes balls to
yeah, now
to write
I wouldn't
all these
do that.
People.
Back then I was like, who gives a fuck?
Yeah.
The first thing they're going to do is not reply, which
yeah.
a lot of them didn't, but a lot of them did. And
yeah, that's cool.
When I moved to the U.S., some people called me. One guy was like, hey, I'm in town. I want to grab breakfast, which
yeah.
is very nice. And everybody said, don't call yourself a Steadicam operator before like the 5-year mark.
Uh-huh.
Because you need that time to learn. And mm. still to this day, I always learn new things. Like, yes, the technology is evolving a little bit. I learn new things in like the technology aspect. But also the workflow, the operating, I always learn. There's always something that I didn't know or, you know. But if I had gone freelance after like maybe 2 years, I would have been too green.
Yeah.
They would have eaten me alive out
mm.
there. I wouldn't have felt comfortable doing it. Because right now my big thing is that nobody waits for camera. That is my rule, because you don't have time on set.
Mm.
Time is expensive. You don't have time to waste. Mm. And I don't ever want to be the reason that we're late or right. the production is losing money now because Henry didn't know what the fuck he was doing over there setting up the camera.
It sounds like a tense environment. You can really mess up there.
Yeah. And especially when, you know, you have an assistant director staring you down constantly. You know, like, how much more? How much more? Two more minutes? Three more minutes? Two more minutes? That's when mistakes happen.
Mm.
So now I've been doing this for 10 years. I'm comfortable enough to give people a concrete, like, in 15 minutes, everything will be set up.
Mm.
Please don't bother me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've learned it pretty quickly that it's kind of boring here. But it was necessary.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you go out to university, I'm pretty sure it gets pretty boring after a year or two also.
Dude, maybe. Everything has boring aspects to it.
Of course. Yes.
Right. I found out with this project, like, I find it pretty boring to edit the podcast, but you gotta do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least I have to do it in the beginning to hear myself mess up and think, this is how I can do it better next time.
Everything is boring. But it's necessary.
Yeah.
You know. And yeah. Now I don't know where we were.
You were, if you like follow the timeline, then you were telling about when, you know, you arrived in LA and those first jobs, you did ads and you did music videos. And I wanted to ask you on that, like, I assume it's a bit more of a rock star feeling when you record a music video, or is that the case? It's like a... There were like parties in connection to it, and that it was like some wild situations, or am I wrong there?
Sometimes, maybe not for the production department so much.
What was the most fun music video recording?
The most fun music video recording. The most fun were actually the really young artists.
Yeah.
Because they really appreciate you and your crew.
Yeah, they're not blasé yet. Everything is cool.
Exactly. Like, to them, everything is new and special. And
yeah.
Like, now I'm in the center of attention. There's 20 people around me just because of me and to, like, fulfill my dream.
Yeah.
These people are very appreciative. Mm. I know my wife at the time, she would do a lot of, like, A list music videos, Taylor Swift and stuff.
Mm.
And she said that was not very fun, to say the least.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they're probably not enjoying themselves so
they're
much
not enjoying
anymore.
Themselves. They not only really don't appreciate the crew, they get annoyed by the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you don't have that with, you know, newcomer artists.
Right.
Like a rock star feeling, partying. Nobody wants to party after a 15-hour day at work.
Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah.
The party would be the bed or the shower. That would be my party.
Yeah.
There would be nice get-togethers amongst the Steadicam community. We would try to get together maybe once a month in Hollywood or in the Valley to grab beers and stuff. Mm. That was always fun because you're in a room of, like, with 20 people who all do really cool things. And odds are, like, there was one Steadicam get-together at, like, a taco place where it doesn't matter what movie you just watched or which TV show you just watched, the guy is in the room who did that. And that's an amazing feeling. Like, you know, in Los Angeles, you maybe have, I don't know, like 15 Steadicam operators, 20 Steadicam operators on that level. And then all of a sudden, everybody is in the room with you.
Ah, that's cool.
And that's cool.
Yeah.
Know? So then COVID happened.
You're in LA when COVID began.
Yeah, I was in Los Angeles when COVID began. I didn't work for like 4 months, 5 months, and nobody knew when it was going to normalize again, reopen again. Like, I did a few commercials at the time. under strict COVID rules, and then all of a sudden it was just like back to nothing. Like they were like, okay, we have to stop production again. It was deemed non-essential by the state. So,
oh, dude. So without COVID, you would probably not have been here.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah,
without COVID, I would still be there.
Yeah. And you would have probably not have shot your own movie.
Maybe not. I don't know. That was always a goal of myself to do this in Los Angeles too, which I'm still a little bit sad that I haven't done that.
Mm.
That doesn't mean that I won't in the future.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no, without COVID, like this second half of my life, basically, this really significant portion of my life, wouldn't have happened. So I don't know. It's maybe weird to say I'm thankful COVID happened.
No, but it is like I think almost any crisis, even though it sucks when it happens, can give really valuable lessons or bring you to a nice place later on.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of things that I've thought were really sad or sucky or call it what you want have also come with good aspects, be it breaking my knee surfing or something as heavy as losing my mother, which was a real crisis, but it taught me a bunch of valuable lessons too and changed me in a significant way that I'm happy for nowadays.
It's funny you mentioned losing your mother was a significant event, which it is. I can imagine. I lost my dad last year, and without that, I wouldn't have done this movie. I know that because one of the last conversations with my dad was about this film. And I said, I have a plan on like shooting something. I want to do this, but I don't think I'm going to. And he was like, why? Just do it, man. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, the worst thing that's going to happen is it sucks. Okay. It was your first project.
Yeah.
Who gives a fuck? But just do it, man. And that was the last, I want to say that was the last conversation I had with him. And without that conversation and without him passing, I wouldn't have done this.
Yeah.
I remember
you told me at the dinner that I was referencing to, and you told me about the story of your dad. Briefly, he was very successful at his job, but he did. It sounds like he prioritized money and financial security above his passion.
Correct.
And that the background of his message to you was like, more or less, don't do the same mistake that I've done.
Yeah.
Go ahead and follow your passion now without thinking
exactly
about the downsides, which is a super valuable, nice lesson to pass from a father to his son. And that then became very, how fortunate that he had time to tell you that. Because neither him nor you, of course, were aware of that this is the among the last things that you say to each other.
Exactly. It was probably the most important lesson I've ever learned from my dad.
It's powerful.
It's very powerful because I love my dad. Though the majority of things I've learned from him are things to not do in life.
Yeah, but dude, like, what not to do is also really valuable. That's how I'm also happy about coming back to crisis or things that have sucked. You know, at least you come out with like, okay, now I really know what not to do, and to like go back to this, like being 20 and exploring the world, like a challenge that I was facing. Like I didn't know myself, and I was like, oh, I'm open for anything, right? You haven't made those painful lessons, and the older you get, then you're like, you just gather more of that. I definitely don't want to do this, and you become more rigid, maybe, but at least then you can turn it into a focus. Then it's valuable.
Yeah, because if you don't learn from these lessons or any lessons or any crises, then what's the point? You know, like, then you're not adaptable to the future.
Yeah.
So there's a silver lining in anything and everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. It's the silver lining in tragedy.
Yeah, yeah. So before we hit record, I bragged about, oh, I have such, I have a structure. It's the first time that I have a structure for an interview. And when I look at my structure, the very first thing I wanted to ask you, I haven't really succeeded in asking so far. I think we should give the listeners the benefit. Like, please, would you like to tell what's this movie about that you now recorded?
It's a silent film about poverty and isolation in old age. The reason for being a silent film is two reasons. Reason number one, nobody does silent films anymore. It's kind of a lost art because I have a background in camera. If you had listened and paid attention these
hopefully
20 minutes, you know that. So to me, it's very important that the pictures tell the story. You should be able to mute your TV and then still kind of know what's going on the screen.
Do you have, like, in these Charlie Chaplin movies that, like, there's this cut with that there's text explaining stuff? No, you don't have that, no.
I thought about it, but I think that's too old-fashioned.
Okay.
I have a modern approach on it.
Yeah, okay.
There is background noise. There is some supporting conversation in there, but not from the main character.
I get it.
And reason number two is I'm not great when it comes to writing dialogues. I'm okay, but it's not like my forte. So I figured that's why I write a lot of scripts every once in a while when I have free time.
Yeah.
And then they just die in the process because I get hung up in some conversation dialogue in the movie that I read and it sucks. And then I lose my motivation.
Yeah.
So I figured I'm going to just write something where there's no conversation in it.
Interesting.
For my first project, at least. And then for the second moving on, third projects, whatever, I can add dialogues. But I figured just for the beginning, I want to show the people a film that has nice pictures in it that tell the story.
Mm.
So yeah, it's a movie about, it's about 15 minutes long, so it's a short film, of an old lady who lives here in Berlin and has kind of lost her ability to be social around humans. She feels more connected to materialistic things. And it kind of touches on the whole isolation and poverty in older age. I mean, she's in her 60s, so it's not like super old, but it's an
issue that you see everywhere,
Especially in cities that have become more and more expensive, especially for people who maybe don't work anymore. I feel like it's an important story to tell, and I found this actress who can express her emotions so perfectly with her vision and mimics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so happy with it because I did some castings with some actors and they either told me up front, I don't feel comfortable doing this because I do rely on dialogues and conversations to convey my messages and emotions. Or that said, oh, yeah, I can do this. And then we did a little casting practice session, and I thought, like, oh, maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
And then my producer friend recommended somebody, and time was a little bit of essence then, and I was a little bit forced to say yes to her, believing that she does a good job, and she absolutely did, and she delivered so wonderfully. I'll show you some things later.
Yeah, please do.
And the whole movie was a learning experience for me because I had never been the boss of like 20 people on set. I had a lot going on, you know, focusing on telling the story, but also focusing on the administrative side.
Right.
The business side of this. Producing this without completely bankrupting myself, which kind of didn't work out.
Oh, no. So you blew the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now I've learned, like, the budget that you set yourself, you can basically add another 50% to it. But
I think it's not unique to you. It seems like most budgets
exactly
get blown up.
Yeah.
Completely. Especially in Berlin.
especially in the movie industry.
Yeah.
Especially when you get invoices weeks later that you thought, like, huh? Who's that person?
Oh, okay.
Or if you park 6 trucks on a private lot that is under video surveillance, and then they send you a parking ticket for 6 trucks and 2 cars in the mail. Anyways, apart from that, it was an amazing learning experience.
It was
the moment where I realized this is what I want to do moving forward.
Yeah.
Because I wrote a script for a miniseries that was going to be my primary project, but I realized I need to do something small first.
Right.
Because if I commit to this giant project that nobody would finance anyways if I had never done anything.
You need a stepping stone.
I need a stepping stone.
This is your golf channel.
This is my golf channel.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. This is my proof of concept.
Yeah.
You know. This is my, because I don't know, like I probably didn't sleep for like 2 days before our first day of shooting for time reasons, but also for like stress reasons.
You were back into the, perhaps a bit this vibe before your first Steadicam shot at the golf channel.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
That is a great analogy. Yes, exactly. That is exactly what happened.
It's painful to be there, but it's also cool because you learn a lot.
Yeah. I don't even know if I did this movie. I know I look at photos and I was there on set,
but the stress level was,
at least for like the first day.
Yeah.
We shot 3 days, one reshoot.
But dude, this is very cool because what I hope to achieve with these kind of conversations is to inspire people to give whatever they want a try.
Exactly.
And one takeaway that if I would be a listener, is that like, make sure you have it's okay to have stepping stones.
Yes, exactly.
You need stepping stones. It's fine.
Yeah, you don't.
Don't overshoot. But probably many projects die of people having too big of an ambition and then they don't know, like, how do I get there? And
exactly.
It's too difficult. Now I go back to.
You don't know if you can do it, you know, because I didn't have complete faith in me before I started this project because there are so many variables that I can fuck up on.
Yeah.
Steering this big ship through the oceans of production.
Yeah, you know? For sure.
You don't get your driver's license and then you buy a Ferrari right off the bat. You know, you start small. And
I mean, some people do, but then it often doesn't end so well.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So this opened my eyes and I made up my mind that this is what I want to do moving forward.
Cool.
Making my own stuff, becoming a filmmaker. Oh my God, I just said it.
And where can people watch this movie?
I'm not sure yet. I did not start this movie with the intention of showing it at festival A, B, and C. I did it with the intention of I want to finish it first, and then I'm going to decide where I want to show it.
Mm.
I want to show it probably at the Deutscher Kurzfilmpreis oder Deutsches Kurzfilmfestival. Den Preis habe ich noch nicht gewonnen. It will be next year sometime. It's the German Short Film Festival.
Here in Berlin?
Here in Berlin,
yeah.
The deadline to submit the film was like the week we actually filmed the movie.
Oh.
So I do have a year, give or take, to submit it.
Ah, yeah.
But I've worked on a lot of short film projects where the directors are on set and they're like, I'm going to submit this to South by Southwest. This will be submitted to Cannes. This will be submitted to blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking like, dude, finish the fucking thing first and then see where you can take it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, don't put the cart in front of the horse.
Yeah.
Finish your movie. So now I'm at the point where I said, you know what? I don't know what I'm going to do with it. This is my own little proof of concept.
Right.
I do want to show it somewhere, of course.
Yeah.
I do want to use it to submit, you know, I want to use it as a proof of concept to get money for my big film.
Mm.
But I will figure this out once I'm done with it.
Yeah.
Done cutting it and finishing it.
And when do you when are you done cutting?
I have a rough cut done right now.
Yeah.
I need to get an editor. I cannot cut this by myself. It's not very good. And then I have to do the scoring and the audio, which being a silent film, the pictures are important, but also the supporting audio with it is really important. I did set myself a deadline for August.
Yeah.
Because there's some deadlines for submissions for festivals around September and October. Mm-hmm. So I want to be done by then for sure. Mm-hmm. So about 2 months. Mm. And then I have a friend of mine who also produced her first short film. And we were thinking about just renting out a little independent movie theater in Berlin and then show these two films back to back and have a little made in Berlin short film session in a nice theater, you know.
That's cool.
With people attending and
Yeah, that sounds like a nice
enjoying
thing.
It.
What would you say, what's been your biggest mistake or fuck up during this journey?
A lot of things, I think. But I don't know, they made me stronger, wiser. I think...
Do you have any regrets?
Sometimes I regret moving to Berlin.
Oh, you do?
Because a lot of my friends do some really cool shit in LA.
Yeah.
But then again, I do some really cool shit here too.
Mm-hmm.
The grass is always greener on the other side.
Yeah.
I know if I had moved here and then moved back to Los Angeles, I would see all my friends in Berlin doing cool shit and I'd be still like, oh my God, why am I not there?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think my biggest regret is that I didn't do that one short film in Los Angeles, even though we had time because of COVID and I had my friends there supporting
right.
me saying, hey, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's do it. And I had this fear of, oh my God, what if I don't deliver? Oh, what if I can't be a good boss? All these things where my dad later told me, who gives a fuck, dude?
Yes.
Just do it. I had a conversation with him before that, or in Los Angeles, I would have done it there. But now reflecting, I was in this great city, the mecca for movie industry people,
yeah.
and I didn't do my film there. I do regret that,
yes.
which now gives me the motivation to go back one day and do it on a bigger scale, which is nice, you know, also nice. But... I think that is the biggest regret, biggest professional regret.
Like not getting going before.
Yeah.
I recognize that this is a much smaller project to record a podcast, but like I've had the thought for a long time and I've also recorded episodes back like almost 5 years ago that I never published for fear that, oh, what are people going to say? Or like, it's not good enough or whatever. And so now it's important for me to publish, even though I'm not totally happy with the outcome. And I also plan to publish the old episodes. Doesn't matter.
No, exactly.
It's just a good habit to publish. It changes
the
game.
Yeah, it does.
If you do.
Yeah.
It's totally different. Like I can't put my finger exactly what it is, but it's something different. Even though you've done the work already, if you publish it, you have a different relationship.
Absolutely.
To it, and you give the work a chance to do something for you.
Yeah.
So.
Just do it. It's so weird. I used to have these shoes from Under Armour that I bought when I started at the Golf Channel. And I believe it's a Bible quote. Don't quote me on that. But it says, you can do all things really small on the bottom of the shoe.
Yeah.
And at first I thought it was really gimmicky.
Yeah.
But then reflecting, I'm thinking like, you know what? It's kind of right. You know,
yeah.
you can do all things if you just put your mind to it.
Yeah.
And kind of like, I'm always this big person who's like, oh my God, what do other people think?
Yes.
And that has caused a lot of
that's terrible
problems in my life. And I know it's really easy to say, who gives a shit what other people think? I give a shit.
Everybody.
Everybody does.
Almost everybody. But that's maybe also like we're really fascinating people. What unites them are, I don't know if it's true, but like more interesting people often don't care too much what does.
Yeah. It's a process.
What does the average show think about me?
Exactly.
Really difficult to be interesting or do interesting work if that occupies your mind. I find you can see that with kids.
They don't
give a
shit.
Some
or
do.
They do.
Some do. There's two girls related to me. And one of them, you could tell that she's occupied by, am I getting attention? What do people think about me? And the other one is just in the moment doing her her thing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the latter gets all the attention because more interesting and fun to view what someone is doing that just does their thing other than someone that's occupied grabbing the attention or massaging the message in the right way or be seen in the right way. It's not so, as interesting. So
it's a learning process, I think. It's a learning curve to shed that notion and fear of what other people think.
But that's something that, is, you know, not many life advice are true for everybody, but isn't it true for almost everybody that you'd do better if you wouldn't care so much about other people's opinion of you?
Yeah, absolutely.
I watch a lot of YouTube. The algorithm knows me quite well. So now I'm starting to get, I got these clips recommended for Nietzsche. Apparently Nietzsche was quite occupied with, oh, you have him here? Yeah, he was occupied with that, like a good life, like lived, I'm going to butcher it completely, is when you stop giving a shit about what other people think.
Yeah.
Your task in life is to do what you're supposed to do without shame.
Yeah.
And that shame is like a tragedy of like, why should you be ashamed for who you are? That's like, you're wasting your time on this planet. Yeah.
I wish there's a button that I can push that turns it on and off in my brain, that function, that like fear of what other people think.
Mm.
I can't, but I'm learning. You know,
but it's a part of suffering, right? That you're like, oh, like
it is.
What are people? And I got another clip about that. Like, maybe suffering isn't bad.
Yeah,
you know, this view that going through life and always feeling great—that's not. You can't be happy that way. Even if you reach that, there are some people that just are surrounded by pleasure and nice environments all the time, but they're often not so happy.
No,
right?
They're not.
It's not a key to happiness. You gotta suffer a little bit.
Yeah, you do.
But like this intentional suffering that you choose is then better, right? You choose to do a hard workout or you choose to publish something and you suffer a little bit and you think, what would people think? And maybe someone will laugh at me or whatever, but like it's a good kind of suffering.
That's a great YouTube algorithm.
Yeah, right.
I just get people making cheeseburgers and stuff.
Really?
Amongst others.
Yeah. No, it's a good algo for sure.
I think suffering, or in like a way, also makes you a better writer because I think it gives you a boost of empathy towards other people, because if you don't have any suffering in your life, you cannot empathize with other people, which is an important aspect for writing, telling stories that are social problem stories, social issue stories. I don't like to suffer. I don't, you know, I'm very blessed and fortunate, but I don't know. It's I lost my train of thought here.
Yeah, that's fine. If people want to follow you on your journey, where do they find you?
An Instagram that is mostly my primary way of advertising myself.
Uh-huh.
It's Herr Henry, H-E-R-R dot Henry.
Mm-hmm.
You can find me there or at gelhart.co. That is my website.
Okay, and that's spelled G-E-L-H-A-R-D.
R-T.
R-T, yeah. I see, good that I tried to spell it out. Uh-huh. And if someone wants to support you on this journey, is there anything else that they can do and follow you on?
Support is always good.
Yeah.
I'm at the position where I'm going to have to pay for an editor and a musician to score my project. If you would like to support it, reach out to me. I would be thrilled. This will be a producer credit for you in the final project.
Woo.
Reach out to me via my Instagram. Reach out to Martin. Reach out to both of us.
So will there be a post perhaps later on Insta to a link, or is it like a...
I will probably link something. Yeah. Yeah. I always feel very shy asking for help.
Don't be.
I know. It's one of those problems circling back to I'm afraid of other people's opinions.
Yeah.
And I feel like every time I ask for help, which is the normalest and best thing in the world,
yeah,
to ask for help, I wouldn't be where I am right now without help.
Yeah.
Yet I have this fear. I don't know why. It's like unreasonable fear, but I have it.
Yeah, it's on this what we talked about in the past.
Exactly.
In this conversation. How much do you need to like to complete this movie? Just to give people
probably around 5,000 euros. To complete the project. I spend most of it myself in the production and pre-production. But I figured it might not be a wrong thing to ask people for help or financial support for this project.
It could be that someone is listening and then they feel like, oh, it could be something.
Exactly.
I mean, there's people where it could be a strategic thing, even though right now it's like a gift, I guess. But... okay, it's probably not bad to have a dude like you and in their network, right?
Because
come on, 5,000 is not that much money. So.
No, exactly. And this could be your opportunity to have a producer credit on a nifty little project.
Oh, look at that. Okay, don't be shy, people.
And rest assured, this won't be my last project.
How do you deal with risks and uncertainty? What's your relationship to that?
I feel like my whole life has been risky and uncertain. I don't know. I just approach everything like head on and I figure it out later, which is
the same.
Kind of fuck you, you know? But
fuck you to who?
Like, I don't know. I feel like sometimes I tightrope over the Grand Canyon, and I figure, you know what, there's no safety in it, but I'm going to figure it out somehow because it always worked out. So I don't know. Like, I just do things head on, and if they don't work out, I figure it out.
Suffer the consequences.
Yeah. And that's like brings us back to a tragedy that produces a silver lining, a lesson learned. You know not to do that again.
Yeah.
And it makes you stronger. You can harness that weird lesson you've learned to your next endeavor.
Yeah.
And it makes you stronger that way versus you learn something from a success story that, yes, also makes you stronger and wiser. And you can harness that for your next endeavor. But I feel like whether it works out or not, there's always a win in it. Even if you don't see it directly, or even if it's not a clear like win, but even a failure can be a win. But yeah, I don't know.
So someone listening that then has their own idea, you know, tucked away in a drawer somewhere, that are thinking about maybe do it, maybe not. Like, what advice do you have?
I would say figure out the most negative of consequences that idea or plan that you want to do could have for you.
Mm-hmm.
Could it kill you? Okay, maybe don't do it.
Yeah,
you know? Can it cause other people to maybe negatively think about you? Fuck them. Do it. Can it completely bankrupt you? Maybe don't do it. But, you know, if you have a safety net, try it. I don't know. I would always look at what the most negative thing could be.
Yes.
And if you can still go to bed at the end of the night.
Yeah.
Safe, happy, and sound without dying or going to prison or something, or alienating your entire family. Do it. You know, what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah, dude, that's good. That's how I thought when I started my first own company. Mm-hmm. Then I thought, what's the worst thing? Okay, the worst thing I could think of is that I lose all my money. Mm-hmm. And it's this absolute failure. And then I have to move back home to my parents.
Yeah.
And live in my old room there. Yeah. I thought I could live with that.
Yeah.
That's better. That's better than going to a bad smelling office where I hate what I'm doing.
Exactly.
For decades.
Yeah.
Working way
for
better.
Somebody else.
Yeah.
To achieve somebody else's dream.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine to work for somebody else if you're in a good spot, if you learn stuff. But I think it's more, about if you like what you do, if it's interesting, if you get a kick out of it. So, no, cool. And do you have, looking into the future, do you have thoughts of a next project already? Or
I do.
Yeah.
I'm almost done writing it. I wrote it as a movie. Now I think I'm rewriting it into a mini series. There's a writer's strike in the United States right now.
Yeah.
And it happened in the past, and it always created a huge vacuum on shows or movies, and you would watch reruns and re-airs for a year or two. And I'm trying to take that as an advantage for me to position myself here in Germany and produce this show. It's not a very German-styled show, German-style to the non-German listeners.
So like a TV show, something you would stream on Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. German productions are usually relatively dry and boring.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a few, I call them Americanized shows in Germany, like Dark and 1899 on Netflix, that are more interesting and nicely shot and produced. And I'm writing something that is along those lines. And that's my goal, to do that, to figure out how to get that financed. First, like, finish writing it. I'm almost done, but how to get it financed and produced in Germany in a timely manner. There is film financing available here. Very good financing. There's a federal one. Every state in Germany has their own financing for films, film commissions. There's private foundations that do it.
Mm.
And if I see what kind of garbage they finance sometimes, I think I can maybe position myself there somewhere.
They were back at those stepping stones, right? You need your own movie.
Yeah, exactly.
A short film.
Yeah.
Then you can submit it to the festivals.
Yeah.
Then you can ask for funding for the next project.
Exactly.
And so on.
And everything has been a stepping stone. Like this.
Yeah. It's not negative for something to be a stepping stone. It can be wildly positive.
It is positive. Like, without having a good background in camera, I would have never done this film. Without having worked at the Golf Channel, I would have never started as a freelance camera person. Without having terribly coiled the cables, I would have never started at the Golf Channel.
Yeah.
Without having the bakery background, I would have never terribly coiled the cables.
Yeah.
So it's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
But I, Steadicam is not very scalable. Like, where I am is basically where I am. It can be a full career. A lot of people do that till the end of their days.
Yeah, sure.
Which is completely cool.
Mm.
But I don't want to. I don't know. I get distracted and bored easily.
Yeah.
That's why maybe I move around all the time too, and like I live everywhere.
But that's a good thing.
Yeah.
There was a time in my life when I was like, oh, why can't I never be complacent? Why do I always have to look for the next job? And can't I just be happy with what I have? But now I'm grateful that I didn't have this Zen mode.
Yeah.
Because it brought me to better places.
Exactly. It's, I mean, I don't think negatively of people that do have that Zen mode, that do graduate school, start their job somewhere, and then work there forever. That's completely cool. It's just not a life for me, you know.
I think it's difficult to be a creative person if you're just like super happy to do the same thing for 50 years.
The creative people I know, they are kind of like me. I don't know. They're like live nomads. They just, you know, travel, go from A to B to C to get inspiration and, I don't know, to appease their inner need to explore life, I guess. But yeah, that's my next step.
Cool.
Fulfilling my dream to become a filmmaker. I've accepted that term now.
Yeah.
It's a good term. I like it now.
No, super cool. It's very cool to follow your journey. I'm very happy that you gave me the opportunity to have this chat with you.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm looking forward to that screening of your
your
movie.
It will happen one day.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Thank you.
Thank you.